I am capable of building and designing an aircraft that can go 210 times the speed of light.
So I brought something up near the end of my podcast with Joe Rogan, something that I've been sitting on for the best part of 2 years. Direct testimony from the individual who claims to have actually seen this vehicle. The illustrations which you are now seeing were sketched out by military illustrator Mark McCandlish after he was given a highly detailed description of this vehicle by Lockheed Martin engineer and inventor Brad Sorensen. Other than an unpublished interview in the 1990s, nobody has ever heard directly from Brad Sorensen. We only have the story about this vehicle from Mark McCandlish. Until now. On April the 13th, 2021, McCandlish was found dead in his home in Redding, California, having sustained a gunshot wound to the head. McCandlish had been scheduled to testify before a Senate UFO UAP hearing in June of 2021. Testimony that, according to his colleagues, would have destroyed the "we haven't made much progress" narrative regarding black budget aerospace programs. And I think it's interesting to note that the people in control of the UFO narrative in the mainstream public sector now are trying to push a very different narrative, that we haven't been able to successfully reverse engineer these technologies, that none of this is human, we can't explain it, it's all alien and mysterious. So this testimony that Mark McCandlish would have provided to the Senate at this point in 2021, complete bifurcation from the narrative that we're now sticking to in the public. I was present in the room taking notes when Brad Sorensen was contacted by a colleague, and what he says will shock you. It's important that everyone listening and watching is on the same page. So before we get into the new evidence that I've been able to secure, we should go back and actually look at the ARV, Alien Reproduction Vehicle, story and the people involved. One of the most intriguing stories in the history of classified aerospace. The Alien Reproduction Vehicle, ARV, colloquially known as the Fluxliner, emerged as a significant element in UFO disclosure narratives following a November the 12th, 1988 classified aircraft exhibit at Norton Air Force Base near San Bernardino, California. The story centers on aerospace illustrator Mark McCandlish, who received detailed testimony from designer Brad Sorensen regarding three saucer-shaped craft allegedly reverse-engineered from non-human technology. Over 3 decades of public disclosure, both primary witnesses experienced extraordinary circumstances. Sorensen became increasingly hostile and fearful, while McCandlish died under contested circumstances shortly before a scheduled Senate testimony. Mark McCandlish was an accomplished aerospace and aeronautical illustrator, whose professional credentials lend credibility to his later claims. Working primarily from the early to mid-1980s through to 2021, he built a substantial client roster, including the US Air Force, Rockwell International, Boeing, and Lockheed Martin, alongside major publications such as Aviation Week and Space Technology and Popular Science. His specialized training allowed him to create highly technical renderings of advanced weapon systems and aircraft concepts, a skill that would become a central point of the ARV narrative. In late 1988, McCandlish received a phone call from his friend Brad Sorensen, describing something he probably shouldn't have seen at the Norton Air Force Base air show. McCandlish had originally planned to attend the event but declined to focus on lucrative popular science assignments at the time, inadvertently missing the classified exhibit himself. Over lunch the following week, Sorensen sketched details on legal paper that he had witnessed. McCandlish subsequently invested years translating these verbal descriptions and rough sketches into refined technical drawings, culminating in March 1989 with his iconic ARV Fluxliner cutaway blueprint. McCandlish's public advocacy for ARV disclosure accelerated after Dr. Stephen Greer founded the Disclosure Project. In May 2001, McCandlish appeared at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., presenting his ARV drawing and testimony to an assembled panel of congressional members, military officials, and media. He continued lecturing, publishing, and granting interviews for 2 decades, but his public work may have triggered the events that concluded his life. On April the 13th, 2021, McCandlish was found dead in his home in Redding, California, having sustained a gunshot wound to the head. The Shasta County Coroner's Office official report classified the death as a suicide from a self-inflicted wound. However, circumstances raised suspicions. McCandlish had spoken to friends and his girlfriend earlier that day, indicating no suicidal intent, mentioning his desire to rest and plans to work at an animal shelter the following morning. More significantly, McCandlish had been scheduled to testify before a Senate UFO UAP hearing in June of 2021, testimony that, according to his colleagues, would have destroyed the "we haven't made much progress" narrative regarding black budget aerospace programs. And I think it's interesting to note that the people in control of the UFO narrative in the mainstream public sector now are trying to push a very different narrative, that we haven't been able to successfully reverse engineer these technologies, that none of this is human, we can't explain it, it's all alien and mysterious. So this testimony that Mark McCandlish would have provided to the Senate at this point in 2021, complete bifurcation from the narrative that we're now sticking to in the public. So definitely a point of contention for the people who are in control of the narrative now, if someone like Mark was still around. That's all I'm saying. Now, Brad Sorensen occupies the role of principal eyewitness to the 1988 classified exhibit at Norton Air Force Base, yet paradoxically remains the most elusive figure in the narrative. An aerospace designer and illustrator by profession, Sorensen had worked for defense contractors including McDonnell Douglas and Lockheed Martin, affording him security clearances to attend restricted aviation events. Sorensen attended the November 12, 1988 Norton Air Force Base show, expecting routine networking opportunities. But through circumstances that remain somewhat unclear, he was separated from his assigned group and encountered a tall man with an Italian-sounding name, believed by McCandlish and other researchers to be Frank Carlucci, the former deputy CIA director, who invited Sorensen to board a military Boeing 727 for transport to a restricted facility. This departure from public view led Sorensen to the United States Air Force Plant 42 in Palmdale, where the true classified exhibit awaited. Frank Carlucci surfaces in the ARV narrative as the likely facilitator of Brad Sorensen's access to the classified exhibit, though his role remains inferred rather than explicitly documented. Carlucci's institutional position in 1988 aligns with theoretical access to such programs. He served as deputy director of the CIA under the Carter administration from 1978 to 1981, held senior Pentagon positions as Deputy Secretary of Defense from 1981 to 1983, and became the 16th U.S. Secretary of Defense under Reagan, 1987 to 89, a position he occupied precisely during the November 1988 events. After leaving government service, Carlucci became chairman of the Carlyle Group from 1992 to 2003, a private equity and asset management firm with over $400 billion in assets and deep connections to aerospace and defense contracting. The Carlyle Group historically invested in or acquired major defense firms, including General Dynamics, Northrop Grumman, and from 1999 to 2001, EG&G. A company extensively involved in classified aerospace programs and famously connected to UFO crash and retrieval program narratives via Bob Lazar's testimony, as well as some mention of it in the Admiral Wilson or Eric Davis notes, the EG&G car park being the meeting place where Eric Davis apparently spoke with Admiral Thomas Wilson, and Admiral Wilson informed Eric of his denial of access to UFO-related reverse engineering programs. Some additional figures that are surrounding the whole ARV story include Alan Cranston, California state senator, documented as present at the November 1988 exhibit by Brad Sorensen. Cranston served as relevant to the stated ARV origin narrative, claiming that non-human entities were concerned about human nuclear weapons. Another interesting name is George E. Brown Jr., a U.S. congressman who was also confirmed by Brad Sorensen to be present at the exhibit. Then you have William B. Scott, Aviation Week in Space Technology, the only journalist to record direct testimony from Brad Sorensen up until I was able to make notes of our recent phone call conversation with him. Scott conducted his December 3rd, 1990 interview, but he never published the full findings in his prestigious publication. I think Scott's reluctance to publish likely stemmed from the extraordinary claims: faster than light travel, 1947 extraterrestrial origins. People weren't really ready to hear that kind of stuff at that point, so that was probably what fueled his reluctance and the social stigma that has surrounded this topic for so many decades, which is now starting to wane. Admittedly, through the people that I have a bit of an issue with, but we can look at both things at the same time. Yes, the stigma is starting to wane, okay, great, but is the narrative that's causing the stigma to wane accurate? That's my issue, right? If it's an inaccurate narrative, it doesn't matter if it's waning the stigma, because it's not true. It's still not accurate. It might not be giving us the actual conclusion. The information is not that solid, and that's my issue. So Norton Air Force Base, located near San Bernardino, California, hosted an official air show on November the 12th, 1988, providing legitimate public cover for a classified aircraft exhibition. The event was purportedly designed to garner congressional and defense contractor support for black budget aerospace programs, specifically seeking appropriations for development of advanced prototypes. The classified portion was not held at a public air show venue, but rather required transport to U.S. Air Force Plant 42 in Palmdale, California, a Lockheed facility that's historically associated with classified projects. It's the original construction site of the L-1011 TriStar airliner, now housed at the Skunk Works. A military Boeing 727 transported selected attendees, including Brad Sorensen, from Norton Air Force Base over to Palmdale. The attendees list comprised approximately 30 individuals described as senior level figures aged 45 to 60, with no administrative support staff. Now, this composition of high-ranking officials without junior aides suggests that this was a highly compartmentalized briefing for decision-makers with a need-to-know access to classified programs. The security posture included men in berets armed with M16 rifles and maintaining perimeter control around the exhibit. The exhibit occupied a massive hangar configured with multiple sections and a large black curtain dividing classified and less restricted areas. Brad Sorensen described the layout as resembling the hangar deck of an aircraft carrier with tightly packed craft, suggesting numerous one-off prototypes and experimental systems within the confined space. Each display featured removable panels allowing interior inspection, technical diagrams and cutaway drawings, and video demonstrations of the operational capabilities. Security was explicitly designed to prevent unauthorized access or documentation, and attendees were instructed to maintain silence about the exhibit. No photography was permitted, and presentation content was restricted to those with demonstrated need-to-know clearance. The exhibit showcased multiple categories of advanced aerospace systems. You had the Lockheed Aurora, described as an unmanned, elongated, flattened football design measuring 100 to 110 feet in length, black exterior with tiles resembling space shuttle thermal protection. The Aurora featured dual propulsion systems, internal fuselage engines for vertical takeoff, and pulse detonation engines enabling supersonic flight to 6 to 8 Mach, approximately 10,000 to 15,000 miles per hour. Presenters made remarkable claims regarding tactical capability. The aircraft could allegedly take out every city of over a million people in the Soviet Union within 1 hour and 20 minutes. The Aurora incorporated synthetic vision systems using infrared seekers, allowing unmanned operation without windows. Then you had the B-2 stealth bomber competitors losing prototype designs from the competition that ultimately selected Northrop's B-2 design. These craft represented significant developmental investment and classified aeronautical innovation. You had advanced VTOL aircraft, various vertical takeoff and landing designs employing hidden thrust mechanisms and specialized landing gear configurations. The V-22 Osprey, the controversial transport aircraft, was present at the exhibit, though its first official flight didn't occur until 1989, suggesting the exhibit provided early access to military industrial stakeholders. And then you had the main event, so to speak, the alien reproduction vehicles. Three craft that were colloquially known as Mama Bear, Baby Bear, and Papa Bear, the Baby Bear being the smallest of 20 to 24 feet, Mama Bear being 60 feet, and Papa Bear being 120 to 130 feet. They were identical proportions across all three sizes. They were hovering, with no visible floor connection or landing gear. They had a 1950s-era appearance, like a jello mold profile, a domed top, sloping sides, and a submarine-like door, and they were covered in a heavily worn thick lead paint with extensive chipping. Numerous fingerprints and smudges made the vehicles appear as if they had been operational for decades. The crew compartment was a separate, self-contained sphere or dome, completely isolated from the propulsion system, featuring no windows for direct pilot visibility. Internal pressurization relied on messy filaments within the crew sphere rather than conventional bulkhead design, suggesting a crude or emergency construction. The smallest ARV displayed four ejection seats mounted on a vertical central beam running from top to bottom of the crew compartment. Seats appeared to be off-the-shelf military components rather than custom-designed for the craft itself. The pilots operated the craft via a distinctive ball control mechanism, a type of sphere allowing the pilot to allocate power to the mechanism multidirectionally, distributing energy across various capacitor arrays. The ARV featured a synthetic vision system compensating for the absence of windows. There were six optical camera bumps arrayed around the dome circumference with an additional sensor on top, allowing the pilot to select viewing angles by a helmet-mounted display. McCandlish described the technology as analogous to the gunslaving system in Apache helicopters, projecting alternating left-right stereoscopic imagery at approximately 30 to 60 frames per second through liquid crystal shutter glasses that create a 3D external view without the need for windows. Radial oxygen tanks occupied the top of the crew compartment, which suggests a reliance on conventional atmosphere rather than a exotic life support system. And rather than conventional jets or rockets, the ARV employed electrogravitics, converting electrostatic energy into propulsive force. McCandlish theorized the Byfield Brown effect being utilized, the tendency of electrostatically charged asymmetric capacitors to move towards the positive electrode when high voltage is applied, as a possible mechanism. This effect, which was first documented by T. Townsend Brown in the 1920s, represents an alternative to conventional momentum-based propulsion and was clearly deeply researched from the 1920s onwards by the US Air Force and other aerospace type of organizations, and this was absolutely one of the most high quality points of evidence to suggest that anti-gravity or electrogravitic studies went into the Black Project. And when the Cold War came around, it all just became so unbelievably classified that we're now having to try and dredge all of this up in 2026. The craft reportedly could output 10 to the power of 26 joules per cubic meter of space, withstand 85 g's of acceleration, and maintain inertial shielding within the local area surrounding the vehicle, which means that the occupants would not experience inertial forces despite extreme acceleration. This is something that's often used as an excuse or a debunk of how any of this could be human-made technology. Well, how could any human being possibly survive the inertial forces of traveling at 15,000 miles per hour and then doing a right-angle turn instantaneously? Obviously, any human being would be turned into mush from the G-forces. Well, not if inertial shielding was a component of this technology, where the pilot was operating in essentially an ambient 1G environment, artificially generated by the energetic propulsion system, outside of the vehicle, it could be operating at insane speeds, and you don't feel any of this. And I think this is one of the very interesting reasons for explaining how this could be possible for a human operator. So whenever you get these senators and congressmen who are just not that well informed, quite frankly, just not that well informed, and they go, "Well, yeah, of course, how could it possibly be human? Look at the speeds, and there's no human that could survive that." Wrong. It's all about the technological envelope that you are using. The ARV required no fuel source, it derived no exhaust, it produced no noise, and it exhibited no visual moving parts. These characteristics, combined with the theoretical energy source and propulsion method, enabled theoretical unlimited operational range within dimensional spacetime. The ARV displayed characteristics that suggested either extensive operational history or perhaps deliberate aging simulation. Could be a reason for that. If it wasn't aging simulation, then we have a thick, heavy lead paint that protected the crew from the X-ray radiation that was heavily chipped and brushed away and smudged, indicating exposure to high energy phenomena and long-term usage. Brad Sorensen also observed that the craft appeared quite poorly built by scientists that were unfamiliar with composite material fabrication. It was exhibiting messy filament arrangements and crude pressure holding mechanisms. So it's a bit like Stephen Greer says, when you can tell which ones are the true non-human vehicles and which ones are the Lockheed Martin and Douglas and Boeing vehicles. The non-human ones are usually described as seamless, no rivets, no bolts, nothing. Whereas the Lockheed Martin clunkers, like the ARV, they've got bolts, they've got portholes and submarine doors, like it looks like a human retrofit. Notably, there were also ejection seats, camera systems, oxygen tanks, and other visible components that appeared to be standard military equipment rather than some form of custom design for this particular exotic vehicle. So very much a kind of slap job. And yet they were still able to create these incredible powers and 85G turns and 10 to the power of 26 joules of power. It just shows that we're being put down a route technologically in terms of the conventional avenues of science, where this should be realized intuitively and logically by scientists, but is not. And the reason why it's not is because so much of this science has either been relegated to the fringe and laughed at, so it isn't being academically explored, or the science is classified. So the mainstream doesn't even know where to look, and if they do go down the right avenue, they either fall into a non-disclosure agreement type situation where they're brought into the program, or they're just laughed away by their peers who are going, "What, are you trying to work on anti-gravity and warp bubbles? You weirdo, that's not real." So it censors itself like a feedback loop. The secrecy and the stigma. The secrecy and the stigma create this feedback loop where we don't create any innovations from within these areas of design and science and engineering and propulsion and physics. It just keeps on feedback looping and we keep going down the wrong direction. Now, according to testimony from presentation officials, the ARV program originated from a foundational 1947 event. Now, this is very likely being inferred as the Roswell event, but that is not explicitly stated. However, it is basically laying the foundation of, we found a vehicle, we've been working on trying to reverse engineer that vehicle. And this is the result of our reverse engineering thus far, these three ARVs. The narrative that they were given during this exhibition was that there were non-human entities that made contact with the US government back in 1947, warning us against nuclear weapon proliferation. The warning was accompanied by a cease and desist message regarding atomic weapons testing. The US government, still euphoric from victories in World War II and dismissive of extraterrestrial authority, attacked or attempted to capture the contactee craft. The entities, unwilling to engage in conflict, destroyed their own vehicles and attempted to retrieve all hardware. Some craft components survived destruction and were recovered by US forces. Scientists and engineers were unable to make the recovered non-human craft functional. Rather than attempting direct replication, they conducted systems analysis and constructed their own versions based on observed principles. The ARV represented a human interpretation of alien technology, scaled for human pilots and crew configuration. Only three ARV craft had been constructed at the time of the exhibit. All three were believed to be operational and had been deployed throughout the solar system. The presentation indicated the craft were intended for demonstration to congressional and defense contractor leadership to secure funding for expanded production, and the program operators sought to encourage continued investment in what they framed as a revolutionary aerospace capability with applications for national security. I have had additional corroboration that these vehicles were internally understood and recognized as instantaneous nuclear payload delivery systems, which is something that I brought up on the Joe Rogan Experience, that the internal classification of this, I have been told, is an instantaneous nuclear payload delivery system, a platform that can instantaneously deliver a nuclear weapon to any point in the globe.
They were described as instantaneous nuclear payload delivery systems. That's the way that they were actually classifying them. Had a nickname for them.
Instantaneous
nuclear payload delivery systems. Like the idea that you could just instantaneously deliver a nuclear payload to anywhere in the world.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
So that's the story that we have been given via Mark McCandlish through the testimony provided to him by Brad Sorensen. And I do think it's extremely important to highlight that Mark McCandlish had been scheduled to testify before a Senate UFO UAP hearing in June 2021, with testimony that, according to colleagues, would have destroyed the "we haven't made progress" narrative. I find this extremely interesting because this is exactly the narrative we're being pushed to believe by people like Lou Elizondo, by people like Christopher Mellon, and other members of the Tudor Stars Academy team that arrived onto the UFO scene in 2017. They've consistently pushed a narrative that none of these UFOs represent human-made technology, that none of this is possible for us to achieve ourselves. We have no idea who is piloting these UFOs or how they work. And this narrative completely contradicts Mark McCandlish's story. So his testimony at an official Senate hearing, his testimony being put into the record, that would have been a problem. It would have been a problem. And that problem was solved by his death, whether intentional or not. That's all I'm going to say. James Allen's death in December 2013, occurring shortly after completing his Zero Point documentary, was another extremely suspicious moment in the ARV Fluxliner story. For a university project, did a film on the ARV Fluxliner, Mark McCandlish, Brad Sorensen. He was investigating this whole issue, and his death occurred within months of his movie, his film documentary coming out, the ARV Fluxliner Zero Point documentary. The death occurred under very unusual circumstances. It was a rare, extremely aggressive cancer diagnosis, approximately 2.5 months before death, with rapid deterioration despite treatment. And this is where it gets really quite unsettling. Toxicology reports post-mortem revealed heavy metal and radioisotope contamination, specifically thorium and uranium, in Allen's body at the time of death. The source and the timing of this contamination remains unknown and unexplained. Some researchers propose that Allen's death represented institutional retaliation for the documentary's completion and planned distribution, similar to suspected circumstances surrounding McCandlish's death. The presence of radioactive materials in a filmmaker's body, absent any legitimate occupational exposure history, and off of the back of doing an expose on something extremely classified in the black budget aerospace world, I mean, the heightened suspicion of deliberate poisoning, I think, is very well justified. So I'm now going to read you the notes that I took of what Brad Sorensen said on the phone to my colleague, because Brad had a lot to say about not only Mark McCandlish, but about his own aerospace capabilities. At the end of the day, you have to decide for yourself if you believe what Brad is saying, but this is what Brad said to us on the phone about 2.5 years ago, and this is the first time that I'm actually speaking about this publicly. The following statements are from Brad Sorensen. I'm working on things I started working on at Area 51. So these people know me, okay? They know where I live. They would just fucking fry me. They would fry me. So we are designing an aircraft that goes 210 times the speed of light. 210 times the speed of light. So here's the cool thing. If we wanted to visit an exoplanet that is spinning around Alpha Centauri, which is one of our closest stars, it would take roughly 6 days to get there. And then we can do research, and we can look at what's on the oceans, and we can check out the planets, and then we can come back, and we'd be back within a month. That is priceless. We human beings have to realize that we're not alone in this universe, and if we screw up this planet that has an atmosphere around it that, in proportion, is thinner than the shell of an egg, if we screw up that atmosphere, we're gone, we're dead, we have no more future. So I signed an agreement with the government that I would keep their secrets for 30 years, and I've gone past that, and they wanted me to re-up, and I said, absolutely not, I'm a free man, I'm an American. Now, Brad was then asked a question about Mark McCandlish. He was asked, was Mark McCandlish accurate in his portrayal of your story, or was it conflated? Brad Sorensen's response, that's classified. I can't say whether it is or isn't. It's classified. But I've also told you that I'm capable of designing and building a ship that will go 210 times the speed of light. Does that give you an idea? The people who I work for, the people who are fabulous to me, okay? And the people who are going to fix this beautiful planet, they don't want people to know what they're up to. Why would they? Why would they? Because I can trust an individual, but I can't trust a herd. Mark McCandlish could have had it all. I was trying to hand him the key to the universe, literally. Because I was so busy back in 1986 that I didn't have time, and he's a very good painter, so I thought, wouldn't it be great to hire him to do some paintings and illustrations of these new superluminal craft? And I invited him to join me, and he paid me back by telling the world about it, even though I told him time and time again, you've got to keep this secret if you want to work for me, okay? He was a bombastic fucking idiot. He was absolutely into himself only, and he was a, how can I put this, narcissistic, I don't know, you know, just look at me, look at me, look at me kind of a guy, okay? Well, he blew it, because he could have worked with me on these craft, which, by the way, were built all up. We've been to every piece of rock in this solar system, and what we found is that we must make the Earth work. Now, those are the verbatim notes that I took from hearing this conversation with Brad Sorensen. It's up to you, like I said, to decide for yourself whether or not you trust his position and his testimony. He claims that he is capable of designing and building a vehicle that can go 210 times the speed of light. He was very angry at Mark McCandlish for actually revealing this to the world. Mark McCandlish was then obviously found at his home with the suicide or potential assassination claim surrounding his death. And then you had James Allen, who made the documentary surrounding this whole issue. 2.5 months later, he's dying from a rare and aggressive cancer with traces of thorium and uranium. Now, I'd like to think that at this point, we've moved through the coverage of these types of subjects in the public sphere to the point where I don't need to be worried for my own life. Nevertheless, let's just see what happens. I guess we'll just have to find out.